Good evening. My name is Teresa. I'm an alcoholic. Grateful to be here. Grateful to be sober because of a loving God. I always ask you to give me the opportunity to share some things that stands in the way of my usefulness to you. And that is, no matter how many times I do this, it's still awkward. It's uncomfortable. Feel very vulnerable and exposed. It's an honor and a privilege to be asked to speak in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous and to be invited anywhere, but I didn't sign up for speaking in front of rooms with people. I really didn't. I don't ever remember, and I keep asking myself, did I ever say when I was sitting out there, I can't wait to get to that podium and talk to everybody? I don't think so. Even members of my home group, it's fun, I'm very silent. I'll share in small groups and one-on-one, and very rarely, if I had to read, maybe I'll come to the podium, but it's uncomfortable. And a few years when I had started speaking, I end up speaking somewhere, and a member of my home group was there and was so surprised. It was like, Teresa? And when I shared, it was like, oh my God, she could talk. There's a couple of reasons why I think this happens. One, God in His infinite wisdom has used something that I didn't even know that I had, is I do have the gift of talk. I love talking. So it's real painful for somebody who lives with me. I'd be like, and another thing. All right. But one of the main things is I believe that God knows that if He didn't put me in front of you, you probably would have lost me. Because no matter what's going on in my life, I have to expose myself to you. And that's what makes it even more and more uncomfortable. I do it because I have to. I do it because somebody did it for me. I know that I sat in chairs like that, in rooms like this, early in my sobriety, and people from this podium changed my life. And I don't know if they were having a bad day or if they were uncomfortable, if their sponsor made them do it or they were forced to do it because they can't turn down an AA request. But I know that they did it. And so I'm willing to do it too. But I always have to share that first. If not, the rest of my share is weird because I'm very uncomfortable right now. That's why it takes me long. I'm usually caught in the bathroom trying to hide out and they got to go find me. This time I was just trying to get food for later, so I apologize for being late. I was like, oh. And I think that's why they give you a host. So I don't, plan my getaway. Anyway. I want to thank the committee so much for asking me to come out. Thank you so much, Qua, for recommending it. I don't know if I should thank you or beat you up, but it doesn't matter. Thank you so much, Katie. We did have a good ride coming out here, and we have so much in common, and it was good chatting with her. It was really good. Oh, boy. I'd like to give the committee a round of applause because they really are what a friend of mine from my home group says, you're our shadow warriors. They're the ones that put in the work all year long, and it's amazing to me how a bunch of alcoholics can get together and don't kill one another and don't get drunk, and they put something on like this. So I know it's only the grace of God, so we can give them a round of applause. And they usually get all the complaints and everything. So I tell folks, if you didn't like how it went or you think it could be better, then join the committee. That's all. At no time did I ever think that my experience can benefit others. Ever. My sobriety date is March 29, 1990. But for the grace of God, in rooms like this, I've had the honor and the privilege to be with you within 24-hour increments for the last 24 years. This is my first time in the program. I like to share that because so far I'm a first-timer. There are some first-timers around here. It is a yet for me to go out, and I learned so much from all of our relapsers and our retreads. I want to thank you for having the experience. For some of us in my home group, we call you our scouts. I want to thank you for scouting for us. I remember early in my recovery, I asked my cousin, I said, why do people go out? Because they say this program works, and if you do the program, everybody should stay here. And she said, think about it. If nobody went out, you would probably be that person that would say, how do you guys really know you can't take another drink? Nobody's ever tried. So we need you, and I ask you to keep coming back. We get to share in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we're like now. And if you knew, there's a reason for that. In the doctor's opinion, it talks about depth and weight. It is the language of the heart. It is the music that I have found in these rooms that nobody else has been ever able to capture my attention the way you've captured mine. No teacher, no lover, no family member could have ever shared this with me. And if you knew, I hope you hear the music. For you see, it goes past your disease that's centered in your thinking. It goes straight into your heart. And once the seed's been planted, you can't drink the same again. We've ruined your drinking forever. As I know you've ruined mine. I want to welcome our new friends. Welcome home. We've been praying for you. I share this wherever I go, and I'll continue to share it. I heard it when I got here, and I believe it. That there is a moment of silence and prayer. It takes place in every meeting all over the world, and that's for you. But for the grace of God, you have been lifted up and brought into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's not your idea. You don't get credit for that one. The literature that we have in the big book, it talks about only an act of providence. We ask you to keep coming back. Don't leave 5 minutes before the miracle happens. You don't know when that is, so you got to keep coming back. Let us love you so you can learn to love yourself. And hold on and strap on, because you're about to go for a ride. I'm so grateful nobody lied to me when I got here. They didn't promise me no bed of roses. They told me this was going to be the hardest thing I'll ever have to do. And they ain't lied. But I don't have to do it alone, and you don't have to do it alone either. I invite you to listen to the similarities and not the differences. And as you listen to the similarities, you get to ask yourself some questions like, that happened to me. I felt that way too, and more importantly, perhaps this program can work for me. And as we say, the newcomer is the most important person in the room, and that you are. I tend to believe it's the coffee person, just because we really trip out when there's no coffee. Take that very serious. But I always like to take a moment, even though we did the countdown, but to acknowledge the old timers. Because I don't know where I would be if it wasn't for you. So I want to thank you for my life and my sobriety. I still want what you have, and I don't ever want to lose that. I get so emotional. I'm grateful that you keep coming back. And that you set the example. And you show me that I too can recover one day at a time, despite circumstances, situations, losses, all kinds of things that I've watched all of you come before me, living this thing called life, and you don't take a drink, no matter what. And I watch you put up the chairs, and you sweep the floors, and you extend your hand. And I'm grateful. I need you. I'm glad we don't get well around here. I'm also appreciative of the old timers who are still hanging out in their home group with one another, not liking each other. There's something about that that's an attraction for me. I don't know if you got that here, but in our home group, well, we got old timers hanging out with each other 40, 50 years, and when one of them gets to the podium, well, everybody still rolls their eyes. And they've been doing that for years. It's hysterical. And the other one just keeps coming back. You know what I mean? It's not like they stop coming. Something about that, I'm attracted to it. So I'm going to share with you in a general way. What's interesting is that when I share in a general way, it's pretty intense. So sometimes before I share, I like to go rated R, adult content, nudity. Parental guidance suggested. And this is in a general way. We talk about living two lifestyles in one lifetime. That has definitely been my experience. I've witnessed miracles in the room, and I've witnessed it when I look in the mirror. You cannot tell me there isn't a God and that this program does not work. That's my experience. I'm in an interesting place in my sobriety. I came to you at the age of 24 years old, and I am now 24 years sober, so it's kind of weird. The identity, you know, of where I'm at, it's weird. They've equaled out, I don't know, it's strange. You told me not to forget my last drunk. And the further removed I become from her, I don't ever want to forget her. I remember telling my sponsor once, I don't want to forget her, I'm so nervous, I'm so different. She said, don't worry, you'll never forget her. There's a thing called memory. So when I talk about what it was like, I feel like I'm talking about myself in third person. Or like I'm talking about somebody else. But man, I can't forget it if I have to keep sharing it, huh? There's so many stories in Alcoholics Anonymous. And it took a long time for me to hear mine. So I want to thank you for asking me to just look for similarities. As the story goes, this doesn't change much. I'm born addicted to this lovely disease called alcoholism. My mother, too, is an alcoholic, and I don't call her that because I want to label her that. She's an admitted alcoholic in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I came into this world unwanted. According to my mother, I'm a product of rape. My father had an entirely different perspective on that story. He wanted a child and he wanted a daughter. Now, my mother married because she had to. She married out of our race. My mother's Puerto Rican and my father's African American. And she went with my father just to spite her family. And she got impregnated with my brother. And my family made her marry my dad. She hated him. But she loved my brother. And she wanted him. My dad wanted another child. And again, my mother said she did it unwillingly. And when she became impregnated by me, she did everything possible to abort me. My mother drank, and she did a lot of drugs, and she was very suicidal. And she put hangers up inside of her, tried to throw herself down the stairs, and needless to say, here I am. And when I was born a preemie. I was born sick, and I was born addicted. And my mother left me in the hospital. And she told my father, you want it, you can keep it, and keep it away from me. And my dad and my grandmother came to get me, and they brought me home. Now, according to them, they tried to give me everything. They tried to give me milk, water, formula, and I wouldn't take it, and I would just cry and cry. And actually, one day it was my grandmother, because they would do this in Puerto Rico, she put alcohol on my gums. And that's when they discovered I would stop crying. And then they put it in my bottle. Now my grandmother and my father came up with a great idea. They were trying to find a way for my mother to touch me, to look at me, something. So they decided to take my brother and leave me alone with mommy in the house. And my mother said I began to cry, and she put the pillow to kind of muffle out the noise. It was just annoying, so she put the pillow over her ears, like, just shut up. And the noise didn't stop, so she went to the crib, and she put it on my face, like, shut up, trying to smother me to be quiet. But then she remembered, if you give her alcohol, she'll stop crying. So from that moment on, my mother made sure that I had alcohol in my system 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. So alcohol was a part of my bloodstream. It was a part of, it's a part of everything. It's beyond normal. It was kind of, you know, I was thinking about this earlier. I'm like, I didn't learn what was inappropriate until I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, I really didn't think that was strange. My brother never understood the relationship that I had with alcohol and my mother. He would witness that. So I described my relationship with alcohol like a love affair. Alcohol was my friend. It was my companion. It was my oxygen. It was my nutrient. I didn't learn about the four food groups till I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. To this day, I still have issues with food. I've had to learn about that. I have a lot of sponsees that when they tend to hang out with me, they'll bring a sandwich and an apple, because we very rarely will pull over and eat. I'm kind of like, there was a bag of potato chips. You didn't have any? Anyway, that was lunch. For years, I would parrot and say I don't blame my alcoholism on my family. I've heard that in the rooms. I'm not sure if I blame them, but I know that they're a lot responsible because I never made a conscious choice to drink. Someone asked me that once. When did you decide to drink? It was never a choice for me. Now, I'm an alcoholic because I like the effect produced by alcohol. And I am restless, irritable, and discontent unless I find that ease and comfort that comes immediately with the first few drinks. And even though I admit that it's injurious, it don't matter. We talk about incomprehensible demoralization. I tell people that was my life. I got adjectives when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. You told me I come from a dysfunctional family. I didn't know that. That was my family. You gave me other words like abuse. There are many facets of abuse. I lose my virginity at 5. Men and women take turns with my body and have sex whenever they want with me. I don't know if I was sold. I don't know if my mom said, oh, I don't know. I just know that that's what happened. And all I said was, who's next? I didn't know that was inappropriate. Everybody's doing it. Don't most of us alcoholics say that? Everybody I know drinks. Well, everybody I know is having sex with my body. Another word you gave me, verbal abuse. All I heard was, you're stupid, you're ugly, you're disgusting, I hate you, get out of my face, wish you weren't born, you're not necessary, you can't do nothing, you're never going to be nothing, can't wait till you die. That's normal vocabulary. That's all I heard. Physical abuse. You gave me that one too. They could spit on me, punch me, lock me up, kick me around, roll me around the floor, kick me in the street, kick me in the house, punch me in the face, punch me in the stomach, beat me with different objects. I tell people the good old days is I can get sodomized, gang raped, and pistol whipped. That's a good day. But you see, I don't know if alcohol talks to you, but it talked to me. And what alcohol told me was, if nobody loves you, I love you. If nobody wants you, I do. You're good. I got you. You don't got to worry about that. You all right? And so all I need to do is I take a drink, and I fix my hair, I put on my makeup, I straighten out my clothes, and I go back out there and I do it all over again. Because alcohol is my friend. And it was my companion, and it was my lover. And it stroked me, and it nurtured me. You call it false pride. You can call it whatever you want. I just know that I walked hand in hand with this thing called booze, and that's how I got through the day. And I tell people, as horrific as that story sounds, I was not present for my experience. Everybody goes, oh, what a horrible childhood. I wasn't there. I was shut down, detached, and disconnected. I didn't cry. I didn't wish to run away. I don't know anything about feeling odd or weird. This is what it is. The very character defects you've asked me to remove around here are the very character defects I was breeding on. You can't survive the world I come from without them. What a different life. Everyone in my family are alcoholics and or addicts. As I said, my mother was going always in and out of mental institutions. She was always suicidal. So I've seen enough two-way mirrors and ink blots and big sister programs and mentorship programs. They would send me to upstate New York with some lady named Bunny to ride donkeys and make apple pie. I don't know what that was supposed to do. None of those things were going to fix what I suffered from. Didn't even know I was suffering. As I said, everyone in my family dies as a result of this disease, whether it's kidney failure, cirrhosis of the liver, falling down, cracking your skull, getting shot, ODing. And when you die in my family, we give you your drink or your drug of choice, we put it in the coffin, and we take pictures with you. And we celebrate your death. And we cry when you're born. I hear a lot of people in the rooms talk and share a lot about how grateful they are to have all their family back in their life. I had to be rid of my family when I got sober. There's only four members of my family who are not, and that is my grandmother, my father, my brother, and my cousin Petra. Nobody ever wanted to be like them. No one looked up to them. It's interesting, when I got sober, that is the family that I began to have. To this day, when I go to Puerto Rico or I go to New York, I can't stick around too long. They'll rub off on me before I rub off on them. When I got here, you told me I need to change my playmates, my playground, and my playthings. That's my family. I didn't hang out in the streets. I didn't hang out with gangsters in the neighborhood. They were in my house. I didn't have to go look for dealers or bartenders. It was in my house. I didn't have to sneak to buy booze. It was given to me. It was a necessity. I never went out, never ran out. There was a constant supply. I never looked at my family and was embarrassed. I have a lot of uncles that are heroin addicts. I would bring my friends over, and my uncles will be nodding, and I'll say, that's my Uncle Peter, give him a minute, he'll come back and finish where he left off. They always do that. They start the story, they nod, he'll come back, wait for him, he'll come back, he'll finish the story, don't worry about it. He's fine, he'll be all right. I didn't play with Barbie doll, hopscotch, jump rope. All my friends are 15, 20 years my senior. My playgrounds are shooting galleries, crack houses, bars, and clubs. To this day, that's a visual safe place. It's the dirty red rugs and the red leather seats and the dark rooms with those little glistening lights, which are the bottles. It's my little comfort zone. I wasn't planning on changing that life at all. I saw nothing wrong with it. It's been, you know, this has stuck with me. This gentleman, I was doing this training, and I don't know if it was a trick question, maybe to really see how honest I was about how normal my life was, but he said, well, if you went through all that abuse, or especially sexual abuse, did you tell anybody? I said, did not not I tell you that it was normal? I told everybody. That's how normal it was. If I didn't tell anybody it was a secret, then I would have known that it was wrong. I would go to school and say, oh yeah, my cousin has sex with me. He just tore me up. I've been bleeding for days. I think I need to go to the hospital. Yeah, I just had three of my godbrothers. They jacked me up. I'm all bruised. That was normal conversation for me. Whatever, I'll be fine. I take a drink and I'm all right. I thought I was going to die like everybody else in my family. And we welcomed it. When is it coming? I was emancipated at the age of 14 from a judge. I was mature at 14. I look at 14-year-olds now and I'm like, I was not like that. I had my own business. I was living with a man who was 26, which is 11 years my senior. And he beats me on a daily basis. You can't tell me there isn't love. That's my man. And yeah, he beats me. So what? That's none of your business. The only thing I ask him to do is not hit me in the face. Because I learned about money, property, prestige. That I need to look good on the outside at all times. I had no idea I was dying on the inside. I didn't know that I suffered from a spiritual malady. As long as my insides look good, there ain't no problems here. And when he beat on me, I used to tell him, are you done yet? You're not tired. You've been beating me for like 45 minutes. There's 15 minutes left in the movie. Can I finish watching the movie, please? You're not tired? I wouldn't pass out. I wouldn't go, don't hit me. I just let him pound on me. You should be exhausted by now. And I'm tiny. I've always been this way. I'm smaller. Sometimes I say, thank God for alcohol, man. As I said, I wasn't planning on changing that life. I really wasn't. I like the hustle, the drama, the chaos. There's a dynamic about all of that. I like hanging out in the bars. I like that movie Cheers. Everybody knows your name. They're always glad you came. There's something about that. There's something about instilling fear in other people. And the sense of arrogance that I walked around in. I'm the type of friend, if you hang out with me and you OD, I put you in the closet, man. I'm not taking you to no hospital. You can't handle your business, that's your problem. There's rules in this lifestyle. So nothing wrong with it, I'm telling you. Sobriety's been a trip. It's the opposite. People look at my life and that was crazy. I'm like, no, sobriety's crazy. There's something about being present for your experience that's kind of trippy. I would always lose my babies. I always share this. I'm amazed of women who have children and their disease. I wasn't as fortunate. My womb was always so polluted and so toxic I couldn't keep a child. And with all the abuse that was going on, there was no way my womb was going to hold those babies. Most of the time, I didn't even know I was pregnant until it fell out on the floor or on the toilet. And when it would fall out, I would go, oh, look, what do you know? I was pregnant. And I would clean up and keep walking. I didn't mourn. How do you do that? What is that? So what happened to me? How did I end up here? To this day, I still feel like I've been abducted by aliens. This has been tripping me out since I've been here. I got so many stories. Taking risks, boy, living on the edge, man. I liked all that. Running off with strangers and not telling nobody, you know? I'm still amazed that I'm alive. You say alcohol stops working. Perhaps that's what happened to me. All I can tell you is that at the age of 24, my life changed. as I had always known it. And the only way I can describe it is that alcohol turned its back on me and left me present in a world emotionally retarded with no coping skills. And it abandoned me and it left me. I don't know about you, but when I got here, I grieved that relationship with alcohol. As a matter of fact, I wore black for my first year. I was in mourning. That's a long relationship, man. That jacked me up. I didn't come here like, oh, yeah, I'm so... No. My life started changing. All of a sudden, I became present for my experience, and I think that's different. You see, I don't mind sleeping with strangers when I don't notice. We talk about sleeping with Cousin It. I slept with many of them, but I didn't notice. And all I remember was sitting at the bar. I'm a VIP. You call it barfly. It's all about perspective. I still call it VIP. I'm sorry. I'm special. I like the idea of not ordering my drink. You know what I mean? It's just there when I come. Perfect. And that's my seat. Move. I still say I missed the nod. We've got a different nod here today, right? We nod, you know, identification. But I still miss that nod when you walk into a bar or a club or something and you can kind of be like, yo, what's up? How you doing? There's something about that. Hey. I don't know. Whatever. Anyway. I don't know. I used to like that. You know, the head thing. Anyway. And all I know is that I'm sitting in my bar stool and I sit down and I look at you. And I take a drink, and I turn back around, and you're still ugly. That tripped me out a little bit, you know what I'm saying? And then I turned around, and I took another drink, and I turned back around, and you were still ugly. And I was like, okay, this is deep. Because you should have transformed by now, because that's how that works. I got this down pat. You know what I mean? No problem when I first see you, and I'm ignoring you. I do this. I turn around, and you're beautiful. But that wasn't happening. And not only did I take another drink and I turned around and not only were you still ugly, I still went home with you. That's a problem. That's a problem, people. Something's wrong with that. And from then moving on, that's what started happening. You know, my bottom lasted 6 months. To me, that was crazy to be present for all of that. When I'm walking up and down alleys and I'm paranoid, I don't know how to do paranoid. What is that? And I walk in a bar and I hear them say, look what the trash brought in. How long had they been saying that? You see, I can't tell you how long they said it, but I remember when I heard it. And that's different. And something happened in my stomach and it turned and I couldn't shake it off, man. And I'm taking a drink because I want the good old days back. I want the days back where nothing matters and I don't care. And all of a sudden I started to care and things started to matter. And I can't take out the look of disgust on my grandmother's face. I can't wash it out of my mind. And then I noticed that Daddy stopped talking to me. When did Daddy stop talking to me? And why do I care? It's tripping me out. I want the days back where nothing mattered, and I couldn't get them back. No matter what I did, I was present for my experience. I was present for my experience. I heard this. Incomprehensible demoralization is a whole lot of things. But when you can't get drunk and you can't get sober, is the worst place for an alcoholic like me to be. And I can't shake this thing off. And it gets uglier and it gets more disgusting. And now I can't take a bath because the water hurts my skin. And I can't look in the mirror because I don't know who she is. Who is that? Can't look at her. And now I'm feeling all the bruises. And that hurts. And I can't get rid of it. And you know, it's a cold thing when you invite death into your life and death don't even take you out. What is that about? When I'm real clear that that is my solution. If I can only die, I don't have to live another 24 hours like this. Man. And I invite death into my life, and death didn't come and take me. So what am I supposed to do now? How am I supposed to do another 24 like this? That no matter what I do, I notice my skin hurts, my stomach turns, my head's pounding, the sun burns my skin. It's too bright, and everybody's moving too fast. And everybody just slow down. Everybody's just moving fast. Everybody seems to be moving really fast. I want the good old days back. And they weren't coming back. And no matter what I did, they weren't coming back. And then death didn't take me. So now I'm pregnant on my fourth child. Now this baby is not falling on the toilet and the floor like the other babies. And it's doing some weird things to my body. And I need to fall out like the other ones. And this was my last run. I call it the aimless walk. The walk with no purpose, no agenda, no destination. It's just a walk. I was living in Queens, New York at the time. It was really cold. The snow was up to my knees. I didn't have a coat. And I ended up in a church, that's all. I've done that walk. When I go back to New York, it's not a straight line. I don't know how I ended up in that church, but all I know is I ended up in this church. And I step inside the church and I felt a presence. I say it's more like what I feel when I come into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. There's a presence in here. Every time I come into the rooms, I stop. Just feel it. Like. And I stepped in this church and I said a prayer. It's a prayer that's different than any other prayer. Now, the interesting thing about this is, was I done? Was I completely surrendered? I don't know. We talked about this act of providence, this moment. Second, when I heard them say seconds and inches, man, where the grace of God, the window was open. That's all. The window was open of the grace of God in this moment and in this state of desperation, isolation, bewilderment. There I stood in that moment. And I said a prayer. And I prayed out to a God that I renounced a long time ago. And I went to Catholic school for 11 and a half years. That doesn't tell you I got a relationship with a God. I know how to say the Our Father and the Hail Mary. I know how to go to confession on Saturdays and I take communion on Sundays. I even sing in the choir. But I stood in that moment at that time. I didn't even know anything was listening to me. And I said, God, please allow me to feel the peace that I feel in this church inside of me. I didn't want it forever. I just wanted one moment for my head to shut up and for my stomach to stop turning and for my skin to stop crawling just for a second, man, so I get a grip, boy. I always say I feel like I lost my hustle. Like, woo, we gotta shake this off. Again, I had no idea that prayer was gonna be answered. It still trips me out to this day. From there, I went to my father's house, and when I got to daddy's house, daddy opened up the door. Now, daddy used to open the door, and he would turn around and just leave, and I can come in. But this time, he opened up the door, and he just looked at me. And I stood there, and I say something to him that, to me, is amazing. I uttered words that I had never said before. I looked at Daddy and I said, Daddy, help me. Now, if anybody ever knew me, I never said help me to anybody. It's not the world I come from. I ain't no punk. I don't need nothing from nobody. You ain't got to give me nothing. You ain't got to help me. No. See, I come from rules with the word help. See, I don't mind helping you. What you need? Because I'll help you because you'll owe me for the rest of your life. So I don't ask for help. So where did this come from? Was God doing for me what I couldn't do for myself in that moment? Because that just came out of my mouth. And my father looked at me and he said, with all the love that a father has for his daughter, he said, I wish I could tie you up and put you in a closet. But I can't. You're a grown woman. He said, but I can't love you enough. So all the love that I have for you cannot stop where you're going. And he said, you're headed in three directions. You're so close to them, you could taste them and you could smell them. And it's jails, mental institutions, and death. He said, there's another road, this thing called recovery. It's dark and mysterious. You don't know anything about it, and neither do I. He said, but if you give it a try, and if it doesn't work out, the other three will be waiting for you. Huh? I always say that that fact that my father shared with me then remains true to me to this day. Here I stand in the crossroads. Those other directions continue to wait, and they will always be there. To this day, when I visit, whether it's my family or I go to New York, there's some people, if they haven't died yet or if they're not in jail, still standing on that same corner. Every year, my birthday, I will call Daddy, my sobriety brother, like, Daddy, another 365. Can you believe it? My dad put me on a Greyhound bus. I asked him to send me to sunny California, where I thought everybody was sober. I thought California was a sober state, no? I think they are too. And it's actually because we have a tradition which is called attraction rather than promotion. As I told you, my mother is sober. She's got 4 years more than I do. Mommy's 28. And I have a cousin that's sober. And when I would go to California, they would come to these meetings. They didn't bring me. I would just be with them that day. So I would come to the meetings. And I would drink before, during, and after. At no time did I think the seed was being planted. I didn't even think I was paying attention to you people. This was Mommy's thing. Maybe you ruined my drinking. But when I was sick and tired of being sick and tired of being sick and tired, I remembered the faces of the people in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I remember your smiles. You know, the belly laughter that we do here. The warmth and the camaraderie that you share with one another. More importantly, I remember that you never shunned me. You didn't suck your teeth at me. And you didn't try to shove a pamphlet down my throat. And for that, I am truly grateful. Because I do believe if you would have done that, I would have been willing to figure out how to die before I proved you right. My experience with Alcoholics Anonymous is very similar to Bill's with Ebby. It is what I saw in you that captured my attention. The things that I heard brought me to ask some questions. Like, you know what I mean? The things that Bill heard, he began to ask himself some questions. But it's what I saw that tripped me out about you. And I got on a Greyhound bus. That's where I detoxed. From New York to California, I threw up, I shook, I sweated, I hallucinated. I had my last drink in El Paso, Texas. There was a man on that bus, I believe, who saved my life. He carried heard me from the bus depot to the bar and he got a drink. I had DTs on that bus. I was really sick. More people died from alcohol detox than anything else, and I was sick. I hadn't had a drink in this body since fetus. I was sick. And that man knew it, and he said, "You must come with me." And he carried me around the corner from the bar. He held the drink to my mouth because I was shaking so bad. And I remember I slopped it up like a dog that had been out of water. I don't believe I would have made it the rest of the way. But it was funny though, when I got back on that bus, that was a trip. I was like, "Woo! I don't know what that was all about." Major breakdown. That was intense. Woo! Oh my. Anyway. That's why I still like that joke that I heard, that joke I heard. I totally identify that. And I might write it in my will. That would be kind of terrible, huh? But I heard that joke that if you take an alcoholic's brain and then when they die, you put it in a jar of alcohol, you're going to hear, ah. Sometimes I'd be like, I should put that in my will. I wonder if they would do it. Anyway. So I arrived in downtown Los Angeles in Union Station on March 29, 1990. That's my sobriety date. Actually, I was celebrating for 6 years of my sobriety on the 25th instead of the 29th. And it wasn't until I came across some postcards. I don't even know when I did this, but everywhere we stopped, I got a postcard. And so I had the sobriety date the day I left New York, but I had to change it to the 29th, no? Because I had my last drink in El Paso. And when I arrived in downtown Los Angeles, I was wearing a size 1 pair of pants and 2 pants underneath. I had a huge sweatshirt, my hair all over the place, and bruises and bumps and things coming out of my pores, and still thinking I was cute, though. That's important. I was 4 months pregnant with a dead baby in my belly. Didn't have a heartbeat by the time I got to California. And my mother picked me up. And directly from Union Station, my mother dropped me off in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And we came into the room and she walked in with me and then she went to leave. And I'm like, "Am I going with you? Where are you going?" And she said, "This is as far as I can go with you." And she turned me over to the very people who saved her life. And you told her to leave me alone. I could play off of her guilt. I could manipulate her. She couldn't help me. I always say I feel like a baby in a baby basket left at the doorsteps of Alcoholics Anonymous. I've been adopted here. They told me there was only one thing I needed to change, and that was everything. It was the old-timers who picked up that basket, who were here when I got here. They began to spoon-feed me this thing called recovery. I always say I came into the rooms. This is the last house on the block. I came to you like I had 20 bullet holes in me. I'm bleeding all over the place. I'm not interested in your credentials. Do you have a needle and a thread? I was dying, and I wasn't sick.